presenter for this session, Dr. Christopher Tolleson. Dr. Tolleson is professor of philosophy at the University of South Carolina. He received his doctorate from Emory University in 1995 and has taught at Princeton, the Spirit and Institute of Philosophy in Ghana, and since 1997, the University of South Carolina. He is the author of several articles and reviews, as well as two books, Biomedical Research and Beyond, Expanding the Ethics of Inquiry, published by Routledge, and with co-author, our esteemed guest for this conference, Robert P. George, the recent volume, Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, published by Doubleday. Before saying a word about the important topic for our session, let me also introduce our discussant, Dr. Justin Barnard, who's director of the Carl F. H. Henry Institute for Intellectual Discipleship here at Union University and associate professor of philosophy. Dr. Barnard holds an MA and a PhD in philosophy from Florida State University and has written lots of things and has a wonderful family. On our topic for this session, disability and social justice, I think it could be said that the measure of a great society is not how much it celebrates its strong, but rather how it cares for the weakest members. We are very fortunate to have with us today Dr. Tolleson, who will lead us in his presentation to consider the degree to which modern political theory makes a place for those within our society dealing with disability and dependency issues. On this most important topic, we are blessed to hear from someone as careful and judicious a thinker as he is. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Tolleson.
I have a pretty good family too. It's a great pleasure to be here, and especially to be here in honor of Robbie, as I'll call him, with due familiarity. I'm just going to say very quickly, I actually know exactly when and where I first heard Robbie's name mentioned, and it involves a use of the English language that I've never heard since and had never heard before, so I'll just share that. In 1993, when I was a graduate student, I was at home, and Germaine Grisez came to visit the family and to present us with a copy of the second volume of his Way of Our Lord series. So actually the date is inscribed on this, so I could find out the specific date that I first heard Robbie's name mentioned. And Germaine said in conversation, "Do you know Robbie George?" And I actually didn't. I said, "No." And Robbie said, "He's a whiz-bang political philosopher at Princeton." And if you know either Germaine or Robbie, then you probably are not going to doubt the accuracy of my rendering of this story. But the core of liberalism as a political philosophy involves the recognition that human persons are free and equal, and that the state and its activities should respect these two correlative features of persons. The way in which these features are to be respected varies, of course, and sometimes radically. Think of the difference between what it means for Locke and what it means for Rousseau, for a state to respect the freedom and equality of persons. But this core recognition is at the basis of both Locke's and Rousseau's thought. It is similarly at the basis of Kant's thought, and it continues to play an essential, even perhaps the essential, role in the liberal political thought of the 20th century, and especially in the work of that century's preeminent political theorist, John Rawls. And the gains of liberalism are, in many respects, obvious, important, and indisputable. Yet in the past 10 years or so, a form of criticism has been articulated that charges liberalism, both in its origins and in its developed forms, with an inability to deal with a significant aspect of social life, namely the facts of disability and dependence. So, for example, have thinkers as diverse as Alistair MacIntyre, Eva Kate, Hans Reinders, and most recently Martha Nussbaum all argued. And I think some of the points that have been already made today by Professor Elstein are also continuous with this criticism. The source of their disquiet is in the interpretation that's been placed on the phrase free and equal, particularly as that interpretation has been seen through the lens of a third trait frequently lauded by liberalism, independence, especially insofar as devices such as the social contract or the original position have been used to model the relations of free and equal persons. It has seemed that what liberalism means by the phrase is individuals with the active abilities and dispositions to assert moral claims and to engage reciprocally with those others who also assert moral claims to their mutual advantage. So, for Locke, free and equal individuals are precisely those capable of entering into the social contract, For Rousseau, those individuals capable of entering into and being guided by the general will. And for Rawls, those individuals capable of being, quote, fully cooperating members of society over the course of a complete life, end quote. Now, on any such interpretation, however, the radically disabled, those whose lives as a whole or for some significant part are characterized by continued and extreme dependency, will be outside the social contract. Their needs will be opaque and conserved for those needs at best an afterthought, a part of the theory to be worked out later, if at all. As Nussbaum points out, the contract theory does not adequately distinguish between those who enter into the contract or frame its principles, who she calls the by whom, and those who benefit from the terms, the for whom. Rather, it's assumed for the most part that those who contract do so for their own sakes. When the oversight is corrected, then it can be seen that, while at least some of the disabled who would not ordinarily be recognized as potential partners to the contract could become empowered to be such partners, still, there are those more profoundly disabled who will never be parties to the contract, and for whom the question of benefits of the contract is therefore likely to seem extra to the concerns of justice proper. Moreover, as Katté especially has argued, insofar as the model person for liberalism is one who pursues his or her ends as a, quote, self-originator of moral claims, and enters into relations with others as a matter of the reciprocity due to those others as free, equal, and ultimately independent, the inevitable concern that some have for the radically disabled will be left out of consideration in deliberations about justice. For while care for the disabled can be, and often is, a source of fulfillment for the caregiver, the claims which the caregiver must attend to in the first instance are precisely the claims of the dependent and not their own self-made claims. Or as Nussbaum suggests, when the independence of the contracting agent is the focus, important issues of justice such as, quote, the allocation of care, the labor involved in caring, and the social acts of promoting the fuller inclusion of disabled citizens, end quote, are deferred or even ignored. Now, there are various ways of responding to these difficulties. In this paper, I'm primarily concerned with political responses, yet I note first a potential metaphysical response with political implications. This response involves a rejection of one ontological characterization of disability as essentially a medical problem in favor of a characterization of disability as exclusively or nearly so an issue of social discrimination. If disability is entirely a socially constructed reality and is constructed by way of indifference or active hostility of the majority to the minority who are different, then liberal justice can be reconceived on a model of justice for other minorities, such as ethnic minorities or women. By seeing the problem of disability as akin to the problem of race, the social model of disability seems to make that problem more tractable to liberalism. But other responses move more to the assumed framework of liberal political theory. One such approach to these difficulties is to reframe the nature of the liberal state, typically by moving beyond the contractarian features that seem primarily responsible for the narrow interpretation of free and equal. Nussbaum's supplementation of Rawls's theory of justice with the capabilities approach, with the foundation in the idea of human dignity, and with an Aristotelian conception of the person, is one example. A second approach is to concede to liberalism at the political level many of the negative consequences for the disabled, and attempt to build a social ethic capable of addressing the needs of the dependent and disabled more satisfactorily than liberalism, but it's something other than a political level. In different ways, it seems to me that McIntyre and Reinders both adopt this approach. Finally, more radical criticism is possible, criticism that holds that liberalism is in some fatal way intrinsically flawed. And Katté, with her principle of dulia or care, perhaps moves in this direction, although she too ultimately seems to stay within a liberal framework. Now, all these approaches, including the radical social model of disability, point to important concerns for a theory of social justice and disability. In particular, there are four, two concerned with the disabled, and two with those whom I will call, following Katté, the dependency worker. First, as the social model is correct to point out, and Reinders also emphasizes, the attitudes taken towards the disabled by society constitute in their own right both constitutive element of justice or its lack and a source of further justice or its lack. A society richly indifferent to or hostile toward the disabled is by that fact unjust and is likely thereby to construe its own terms of existence in ways hostile to the well-being of the disabled. But second, the disabled themselves, even apart from the environment in which they live, require in many cases active assistance to make possible the flourishing they may enjoy, as both Katay and Nussbaum stress. Concern for justice therefore seems to require going beyond a merely critical approach to the hurdles society can place against the disabled to a question of what further steps must be taken. Strong defenders of the social model of disability dissent from this particular claim. Anita Silvers would be an instance of this. Now, on the part of the dependency worker, too, there are two concerns that parallel those of the disabled. On the one hand, there is the attitudinal issue. A society which does not have adequate respect for the labor of the dependency worker seems both constitutively unjust and more likely to throw up hurdles to that labor. On the other hand, dependency workers are frequently not given the special help they need in order to be as capable as they might be of human flourishing, given the demands that they must satisfy as such workers. Now, in this paper, I'll take a slightly different approach than the modern liberal one. Rather than beginning, as liberalism does, with the question of how to model a politics around a particular conception of freedom and equality, I begin instead by asking what the purposes of the state are and arguing that the state exists to serve a set of human needs, needs understood by way of a particular account of human flourishing. This teleological or natural law conception of the nature of the state, I will argue, suffices to justify, and indeed to require, considerable concern for the dependent and disabled, and for the dependency worker, of the four types just identified. Each type of needed concern can be worked into the fabric of the natural law approach to politics, and as I'll show, the foundation for these kinds of concern is the same as the foundational concern that generates the need for the state. That is, it's the same foundational concern that generates considerations regarding all persons within the state. I then address the question of freedom and equality, the question from which liberal political theory takes its starting point. The natural law approach, I argue, can offer a twofold interpretation of freedom and equality, one metaphysical and one political. Distinguishing the two interpretations in turn prevents a potentially distorted focus on citizenship, a distortion that's manifested in one way, under pressure of the social contract, by exclusion of the disabled from the scope of the state's proper concern. Thus, on the natural law view, the disabled are not an afterthought, nor is concern for the disabled extra to justice. But the distortion also manifests itself in a need to see all disabled persons as capable of citizenship in order to be capable of some measure of human well-being. The natural law view need not hold, however, that citizenship is a fundamental need of all the disabled. And it's worth pointing out that naturally enough, the natural law story that I'm going to tell, and here's how I think this I see this paper is relating to Robbie's work. The natural law story is very much the natural law story that, in large part, I learned from reading Making Men Moral. Midway through the paper, I'm going to incorporate an idea from that book into part of what I think is necessary in order to provide justice for the disabled, Robbie's idea of the moral ecology. And in the last part of the paper, I'm going to draw from themes that are common to the work that we did together on the embryo book, work that Robbie has been doing for a very long time, and I'm sure will continue to do for a long time. So the next part of the paper is called The Problem of Self-Sufficiency. And this, again, will resonate with some of what Robbie said earlier. Human deliberation, choice, and action all have as their point human flourishing and well-being. And practical reflection on the well-being possible through action to deliberating agents terminates in a finite number of basic goods, aspects of human well-being recognizable to human practical intelligence as desirable in themselves, and thus as underwriting the desirability of possible states of affairs which could be brought about through action. Such goods include life and health, knowledge, aesthetic experience, work and play, friendship, marriage, harmony with God, and the variety of forms of harmony possible within one's own complex person. Harmony of choice and action, judgment and choice, judgment, choice, action, and emotion. In pursuing these goods, human beings need guidance, since there is a multiplicity of goods, incommensurable each with each. Maximization is not an option, but an attitude of openness to the goods is and is prompted by practical reason. Most generally, such a normatively required attitude is expressed in the most general principle of morality: act always with a will compatible with integral human fulfillment. This general principle can, in turn, be specified further as practical reason identifies ways of willing not so compatible. For example, directly willing or intending damage or destruction to one of the goods. Further specification may bring this norm to bear on an action description that makes it clear that a proposed action does involve such a will, the intended death of a patient in a mercy killing, for example. The norm can thus be applied in the particular case. Here, there's an intervening specification, no intentional killing of persons. This is an intentional killing of persons, therefore it's ruled out. Now, this summary of the first principles of natural law ethics is extremely brief, but it's intended primarily to establish the boundaries at which political questions arise. My proposal is that they arise at a particular juncture where the lack of self-sufficiency of human persons for flourishing is apparent. Individuals just on their own are insufficient for their own flourishing. They require friends, marriage requires a spouse, and even substantive goods such as knowledge and aesthetic experience will suffer in the absence of cooperation and the generation through time of social forms and practices aimed at pursuit of these goods. So a flourishing human life is necessarily communal in various respects. It requires families, networks of friends, and cooperative social structures for the pursuit of goods. Pursuit of the good of religion, too, is typically communal, and in developed forms with traditions of revelation, awareness of the full range of options of understanding and worship requires access to the tradition in the form, for example, of an established church. In all these ways, the inadequacy of individuals for human flourishing is answered by the pursuit of social goods and the establishment of social institutions that serve both individual and social goods. Consider, though, a pre-political society, or more realistically, an overlapping set of such societies, multiple families, social institutions, churches, forms of work, businesses, and so on, all operating more or less in the same geographic space. Considering them as pre-political is, of course, something of an abstraction. This isn't a state of nature argument as such, at least I hope it's not. But the point is to show that although as regards what goods are being pursued, persons in such an overlapping set of societies are self-sufficient, they have access to the full range of human goods, they're nevertheless not self-sufficient in a number of more instrumental ways. In the move from consideration of individual pursuit of goods to social pursuit of goods, there were two forms of inadequacy, two ways in which individuals were not self-sufficient. First, they were not self-sufficient as regards the range of goods they could pursue. Social goods cannot be pursued except socially. Second, they were not self-sufficient as regards their effectiveness at pursuit of the various goods that could only be pursued well socially. The first form of non-self-sufficiency is no longer present in consideration of the overlapping set of societies. All the goods are now being pursued. And the second, too, seems not present, or at least not in the same way. We are imagining a state of affairs in which groups really do pursue, for example, knowledge together, both at a time and through time. And so we can have the development of the sciences in this state of affairs that develops through time. Yet this set of overlapping social realities is manifestly inadequate for human flourishing in the following ways. First, they are subject to external attack from those outsiders who wish to take their resources or otherwise wrong them. Second, individuals are subject to wrongs internally by free riders and violators of distributive and commutative justice. Third, the various groups together suffer from a huge number of coordination problems, a lack of a common and accepted way of doing things together and separately, as regards, for example, transaction of goods, transportation and travel, resolution of disputes, and so on. And finally, and in the context of this paper importantly, there is a further kind of lack of self-sufficiency. Everyone begins life, most end life, and many spend additional periods of their life in conditions of extreme dependency. Within the overlapping web of pre-political social realities envisaged here, many of those in such conditions of dependency are cared for by those with natural obligations to provide for such care. In particular, families owe care to children, to the aged, and to the disabled. Neighbors have some obligations. Moreover, some of the further social groups, such as churches, also take on such obligations as part of their self-understood missions. But the overlapping set of social realities is inadequate to all the problems of dependency and disability for at least the following reasons. First, not all individuals whose lives are so characterized do already, or continue to, live within small social structures in which the obligation to care is recognized and met. Some are orphans, others are parents whose children have died. It's not clear whose obligation it is to provide care, and perhaps it's no particular person's obligation. Thus, there's a threat that these dependents' needs will not be met. Second, some who do have specified obligations to the dependent renege on those obligations or otherwise abuse their charges. Again, the needs of the dependent go unmet. Finally, some, and probably many, who make good faith efforts to meet the needs of those to whom they have these obligations are incapable of fully meeting these needs. Here again, the needs of the dependent are threatened, as additionally are the needs of their caregivers, whose needs include both the care they provide and other needs that might go unmet given the expense of resources on behalf of their charges. Both the well-being of the dependent and of those who care for them are thus jeopardized. The next section is on political authority. I'll return to these three points that I just mentioned shortly, but at the moment I want to draw attention to the way in which these various sets of inadequacies, these ways in which individual and social groups are not self-sufficient, generate the need for a specifically political social reality. All four difficulties may be described as problems of justice and peace. The peace of the overlapping set of communities and social groups is threatened by external and internal force and by the lack of coordination amongst all members. Justice for these groups and their individual members is threatened also by violence and fraud within, by the inability to punish fairly, and by states of affairs in which the needs of some of the dependent and their caregivers are not met, while the needs of others are, or in the most extreme cases, where the needs of no dependents are met. But the overlapping set of social realities themselves are incapable of addressing these problems of justice and peace because they do not have any overarching authority capable of providing definitive and binding solutions to these problems. There is a need, in other words, for political authority. Now, this authority may come to exist simply because some person or group has taken upon themselves the responsibilities of authority and are in fact followed. So there's no myth of consent undergirding the picture. And here I follow John Finnis's remarks on consent. But there are clearly forms of authority more and less adequate to the initial needs and the conditions of the persons with those needs. The authority must, for example, use the coercive force of the sword and make judgments regarding the good and the bad, the right and the wrong, the guilty and the innocent, within the overlapping set of societies. Such power may be used arbitrarily or selfishly. So an ideal of authority can develop in which the agents of authority are themselves governed by the impersonal authority of law, and even further, in which those agents are at the same time both authorities and subjects who take their turn ruling and being ruled. And we're here quite close, I think, to the ideals of liberal democratic politics. But those ideals, insofar as they are liberal and democratic, enter into the picture later than the need for political authority just as such, on the view that I'm putting forth. The needs that govern the creation of political authority are the needs of all human beings within the set of overlapping communities, including those proximate but for whatever contingent reason not currently cared for by some particular community. Call these human needs or needs of flourishing. The ideals of liberal democracy and of democratic citizenship are not foundational needs for political authority, but a constraint on how that authority most reasonably should be constituted. There is a need for such constraints and for a democratic mode of politics, but it's a need of citizenship. The distinction might seem somewhat artificial, but I think it's of help in arriving in solving at some of the most serious deficiencies of liberalism as regards the disabled. And to show this, I first show that the picture I've drawn accommodates all four concerns outlined earlier as regards both the disabled and the dependency worker. And I then show that the natural law approach resolves for the disabled some of the key difficulties raised by the social contract approach. And finally, I turn to the questions of the disabled and citizenship before raising a couple of final quick thoughts. So, the needs of the disabled and the needs of the dependency worker. Two of those concerns noted earlier were, to reiterate, that both the disabled and the dependency worker had needs for flourishing which they and those around them could not meet, respects in which they and their social world were inadequate, not self-sufficient. The very lives of the profoundly disabled are jeopardized by inadequate care, and their ability and the ability of the seriously but not profoundly disabled, both mentally and physically, to pursue those goods they are capable of pursuing, knowledge, friendship, and play, for example, are jeopardized as well by inadequate care and inadequate education. Similarly, the flourishing of the dependency worker was threatened by the expenditure of time and resources that good care for their charges required. We must note that life, knowledge, friendship, play, and aesthetic experience are real goods for the disabled. Eva Kate's description of Seisha, her daughter, who cannot even speak, makes clear that she nevertheless suffers when she's ill, thrives in the presence of those who love her, and is benefited by being able to listen to music and watch skilled performances on television. Martha Nussbaum's description of her nephew, Arthur, who has Asperger's syndrome and Tourette's syndrome, makes clear what an accomplishment it is and how beneficial it is to him when he begins, after 2 years of education, to recognize the importance of inquiring into the well-being of his friends. And even those so dependent that they are no longer capable of responding to the love and care of family members, such as those in a persistent vegetative state, are better off for being loved and tended than if they were to be abandoned, mocked, or terminated. For the profoundly disabled, the possibilities of flourishing are different, and in many ways, it has to be admitted, they're limited relative to the possibility of flourishing for those who are fully capable. Yet they are genuine possibilities nonetheless. The dependent and disabled in question are, after all, human beings, and the goods are human goods. But the ways in which the dependent and disabled are unable to pursue these goods adequately, or as adequately as they might be able to, are continuous with the ways in which all human beings, at various times, are unable to pursue these goods. And they are the very same goods. So the needs of the dependent and disabled stand at the foundation of political society just as much as any other set of needs for assistance in the pursuit of human flourishing. And this is true as well of the needs of the dependency worker, with, I think, one important additional feature. For my purposes here, I'll assume that the paradigm case of a dependency worker is that of a family member with obligations to care for a relative, whether a child, spouse, or parent, in some condition of extreme dependence, whether temporary or permanent. The resources of such agents are often greatly taxed by such work. The time, money, labor, and emotional investment necessary are considerable, and can leave such persons without the energy or material resources to do much else besides rest and care. Kate, for example, notes how beneficial, but unusual, is her own situation in which she's been able to share burdens both with her academic husband and with an almost family-like caregiver and her employee. These demands are threats to the caregiver's well-being, and her ability to ward off these threats is an axis along which she should be considered less than fully self-sufficient. She stands to be benefited as regards the flourishing she is capable of if her family and social networks come to her aid. But these, in turn, may require assistance at the political level. The needs of dependency workers are among the needs, again, foundational to the justification for political authority. Moreover, and here I think there's a crucial difference in many cases between the needs of the dependent and the needs of the caregiver, although not, I think, in all cases, there is in the obligations which unexpected dependency create a threat to the moral well-being of the caregiver. Consider the number of parents who have aborted disabled children, or refused them medical attention at birth, or put away disabled children in homes, or neglected elderly parents, or abandoned disabled spouses. Such behavior is, in a sense, to be expected. The agents must shoulder a moral burden for which they are often unprepared, and which they see does not fall on the shoulders of those all around them. Now, it's a commonplace that the burdens necessary to achieve the common good of a political society should be shared as fairly as possible. To this thought, I would add that certain moral burdens should also be shared to the extent possible. Suppose one believes that abortion is a great moral wrong that should be prohibited at law. One can nevertheless recognize the temptation to abortion suffered by those unprepared to bear the moral burden of unexpected care for a child. That burden can be shared to an extent by providing the social structures necessary to help unprepared parents care for their children and the financial and other resources those parents need to be secure in making the right choice. Similarly, the moral burden of all those in positions likely to suffer a strong temptation to abandon, mistreat, or neglect the dependent and disabled can be shared by a societal willingness to provide similar help and resources. In this respect, political society does not make the right choices for potential caregivers, but it can create to some extent a world in which those choices are shielded from adverse consequences, or more accurately, it can assist others in meeting their responsibility to create such a world. This leads to the second pair of concerns discussed earlier in this essay, those concerned with the moral or other social attitudes towards both the disabled and their caregivers. On the part of the disabled, hostility, discrimination, and indifference result in an environment which is more antagonistic to their flourishing than it need be, or than is reasonable. On the part of the dependency worker, too, indifference and lack of respect results in a sense that their work is unappreciated and that they would be better off doing something more socially valued and financially remunerative. How can we see these concerns as aspects of the lack of self-sufficiency on the part of the disabled and their caregivers, such that they are proper concerns of the state? I hope to suggest the beginnings of an answer by way of analogy. And Robbie, in Making Men Moral, introduced the notion of a moral ecology as part of the common good that a political society exists to serve. The notion fits in with the idea of self-sufficiency and its lack that I've discussed. The ability of an individual to make upright choices is greatly enhanced to the extent that the individual lives in an upright environment, and it's diminished if the situation is otherwise. So, for example, the choice to use or not use pornography is, for competent agents, always a matter of their own will. But they're helped or hindered in making the right choices insofar as pornography is rampant or limited, tolerated or scorned, publicly displayed or only privately consumed. And no individual is self-sufficient to create for him or herself the sort of environment conducive to virtue. This type of legitimate concern of the state with the moral ecology of its citizens seems to me to exist at the border of issues of internal commutative justice, the wrongs perpetrated by one citizen against another. For those who publicize pornography, for example, even if only to sell it to other consenting adults, nevertheless show an unjust indifference to the goods of children and families. But the concern also seems to exist at the borders of issues of internal distributive justice, the need to provide the resources necessary for flourishing to individuals in those respects in which they or their immediate caregivers cannot provide them. For parents, like their children, cannot create an entirely reasonable moral environment for their children except within the home, and even that increasingly difficult. The idea of the importance of a moral ecology as part of the common good makes clear that insofar as it acts with that good in mind, a state is not only permitted, but sometimes obliged, to regulate otherwise private vices for public ends. A morally impermissible but otherwise private taste in pornography becomes a public matter insofar as it helps to create an environment in which the young are corrupted and parents thwarted in their attempts at child-rearing, even if there was no directly corruptive intent on the part of the purveyors and consumers of pornography. We can similarly see attitudes of hostility and even indifference on the part of society towards the disabled and their caregivers as politically problematic because of the social world these attitudes create. For the disabled, this world is hostile to the flourishing insofar as it creates structural barriers to movement, education, and occupation. These barriers are sometimes a function of indifference, sometimes a function of hostility to the disabled, but the situation can be much worse than mere lack of opportunity, as when special inducements exist for parents to get rid of their disabled children, as when genetic testing is used to help parents abort Down syndrome children, as when laws permit abortions of the disabled up to a later date than laws permitting elective abortions, as when medical practice favors starvation and non-treatment of disabled infants, and as when hostility is displayed when the need for publicly funded service for the disabled is voiced. The currency in society of the idea of a life not worth living, an idea for which we're largely indebted to philosophers, I'm sad to say, creates for the disabled a world in which their sense of worth and ability to flourish is jeopardized in ways beyond their control to rectify. Just as the state may clear up the public display and sale of pornography for the sake of a moral ecology, so I think may it take steps to clear up the array of hostile attitudes towards the disabled, not merely by changing structural features of the environment that are a result of those attitudes, like non-ramp buildings, but also by eliminating some avenues of expression of those attitudes, such as prenatal genetic diagnosis, for the purposes of abortion, more permissive conditions for the abortion of the disabled, wrongful birth suits, the de facto immunity of medical practitioners from prosecution for failing to treat defectives, and so on. On the part of the dependency worker, too, the idea of a moral ecology can play an important role. If we take, again, as our paradigm of the dependency worker, a family member who has already got obligations to his or her charge, it's clearly unjust for society to permit an environment in which such workers are considered socially unproductive as drains on the economy, or, in the case especially of parents who have not aborted disabled children, as responsible for their own situation. And that description will probably ring some bells of recognition for the way that a certain mother of a disabled child was treated in the last year. It's no doubt not fully possible for the state to address such attitudes directly. But by changing many of the laws that create an adverse ecology for the disabled, the state can signal support for dependency workers as well as for the disabled. Similarly, by providing the resources which distributive justice calls for in regard to dependency workers, the state signals to all its concern and takes a step in the direction of creating a more adequate moral environment in which dependency workers can not only fulfill their responsibilities, but can also maintain an adequate degree of, quote, the social basis of self-respect. Disabled and citizenship. Now, I've distinguished in this paper between needs of flourishing and needs of citizenship. Societies, and even the pre-political society of overlapping societies that has a need for political authority, all manifest in each and every individual human being the needs of flourishing. But the needs of citizenship are needs that arise in the context of the exercise of political authority. They are constraints necessary for government that is congruent with the status of persons. That status is, as classical liberalism recognizes, a status of free and equal persons. But I would suggest that at this stage of conceptual analysis of the nature of politics, freedom and equality are to be given a political interpretation, whereas in the discussion of the needs of flourishing, freedom and equality should be given a metaphysical interpretation. In other words, the status of beings who may be benefited by participation in the basic goods is the status of persons. beings who are free and rational by nature, and hence equally entitled to full moral consideration. But the beings who meet this description are human beings, and in fact, every human being meets this description. Even the profoundly disabled, even those, for example, in a persistent vegetative state, are members of the human species. And to be a member of this species is to have the radical capacity for free action and rational thought, even if by disease, genetic impairment, or environmental causes, some particular human being or other is rendered unable to actualize this radical capacity. From this perspective, there is no inequality between any two human beings, for all are equally members of this species, a species whose members are, by the fact of their membership, persons. And in honor of Father Richard John Neuhaus, we might just say that were he blogging or writing online right now and were to say something about the inequality of persons, he would immediately follow that up by saying, Robbie, please don't email me to remind me of the metaphysical equality of persons. You're absolutely right. This is a point that Robbie has been making in numerous ways for many, many years, I think, again, very importantly. Yet these claims cannot be unequivocally sustained at the political level. The sense in which adult human beings are capable of governing, as well as being governed as free and equal, is not the sense in which those same human beings are the equals of children, for example, who are not yet ready to be politically governed or to govern politically. Children do not yet manifest the needs of citizens, only the needs of flourishing. The liberal democratic state in which citizens share in ruling and in being ruled is thus a constraint on the political solution to the needs of flourishing. It's an answer to the needs of citizenship. But those with these needs are a subset of those with the needs of flourishing, for whom the political solution exists in the first place. The empowerments, rights, and responsibilities of citizenship are desirable for many, but they are not themselves among the primary needs for which political authority is needed in the first place. In other words, the state does not exist because people have a need to be citizens. Rather, given the need for a state and political authority, citizenship is a supervening need that arises from consideration about how political authority may most appropriately be exercised. In her recent work, Martha Nussbaum goes some distance, I think, towards a position similar to this, in distinguishing between those by whom the social contract is made and those for whom it's made, and in moving away from the Kantian political conception of the person as a rational and independent chooser. Yet Nussbaum's concerns for the disabled still seem fundamentally framed as concerns of citizenship, and indeed, occasionally she seems to equate personhood with citizenship. Thus, when she's criticizing a guardianship model, she objects that this model, quote, makes the dependents not full parts of the we and the our, not fully equal subjects of political justice. They are taken into account because some member of the we happens to care about their interests, not because they are citizens with rights, equal ends in themselves. Or those two phrases, citizens with rights and equal ends in themselves, seem in opposition to one another. Similarly, Nussbaum describes the capabilities, considered as entitlements, as the, quote, fundamental entitlements of citizens, end quote, and later writes that, quote, citizens enjoy full equality only when they are capable of exercising the whole range of capabilities, end quote. What is the consequence of this conflation of citizenship with personhood and the needs of citizenship with the needs of flourishing? Primarily, it seems to me that those human beings who cannot be anything but passive as regards their relations with others are no longer considered either citizens or persons, and thus are excluded from the concerns of the state and the moral community entirely. So, in describing the relationship between capabilities and human identity, Nussbaum writes, quote, if enough of them are impossible, as in the case of a person in a persistent vegetative state, we may judge that the life is not a human life at all anymore. In other words, we say of some conditions of a being, let us say a permanent vegetative state of a former human being, that this is just not a human life at all in any meaningful way, end quote. And a bit later, quote, some types of mental deprivation are so acute that it seems sensible to say that the life there is simply not a human life at all, but a different form of life. Only sentiment leads us to call the person in a persistent vegetative condition or an anencephalic child human, end quote. These joint emphases on active capabilities as linked to both citizenship and personhood create difficulties, I think, for Nussbaum's treatment of disabled persons for whom she clearly has a great deal of sympathy, such as Kate's daughter, Sasha, who's incapable of speech, independent living, and much else. The following passage indicates both the overemphasis on citizenship and the peculiar way it shapes Nussbaum's questions about what is owed to Sasha. Quote, even if Sasha became a potential voter, we should ask what other ways there might be to give her political membership and the possibility of some political activity, although we could allow her a vote through a guardian as a sign of her full political equality. It is clear that citizens with Down syndrome have participated successfully in their political environment. We should ask how we might arrange that Sasha, too, could have some of these functionings available to her. Again, citizens with many impairments are capable of employment. If Sasha cannot hold a job, well, what other ways might there be to give her some measure of control over her material environment? Maintaining a single list of capabilities raises all these questions, and they are vital ones, if people with mental impairments and disabilities are to be fully equal as citizens. End quote. But why must we root these questions through a concern for Sasha's citizenship? Sasha is a human being, among other human beings, part of a family and of at least one friendship, and a part of the pre-political society of overlapping societies, for the well-being of whose members the state exists. That she is not a viable beneficiary of the needs of citizenship in no way jeopardizes her claim to the benefits for which the state exists. In point of fact, Sasha's needs and the needs of the anencephalic child or the adult in the persistent vegetative state are, while more extreme, fundamentally like the needs of every other person for whom the state exists, in that they are the needs of a human being, respects in which some, many, or all human beings are sometimes, often, or always non-self-sufficient as regards their well-being. These differences point to the underlying disagreement between Nussbaum's conception of the person and mine. For her, Aristotelian conception of the person is from the beginning political. Quote, the political conception of the person that the capabilities approach uses includes the idea of a human being as by nature political, that is, as finding deep fulfillment in political relations. The Aristotelian account insists that the good of a human being is both social and political. End quote. By contrast, my view has it that while human beings are from the first social, sociality is intrinsic to their well-being, they're political in a secondary way. This way can be described as natural, certainly, for the need of the political is inevitable to creatures who are social, and the political life, as serving important human needs, can be deeply fulfilling. But it is dependent on that prior sociality and not on all fours with it. Similarly, it is dependent upon a prior set of basic goods, constitutive of human flourishing, for pursuit of which the political is instrumental. This means, to reiterate, that on the natural law view described here, the moderately disabled, the temporarily dependent, the normal human person, the profoundly retarded, the brain damaged, and even those in a persistent vegetative state are all alike as regards the fundamental reason that justifies political authority. All are inadequate in some respect or other for their own flourishing. All lack self-sufficiency in regard to the conditions necessary for them to achieve the level of well-being they're capable of, even when they're situated in particular social networks and the larger web of overlapping social networks. No special attempt need to be made to see any of them as citizens or potential citizens or even like citizens in order to see that they fall within the fundamental scope of the political authority's concern, the basic commitment, quote, to foster the dignity and well-being of all persons within the state's borders, end quote. Now, I go on to say a little bit about a tension that Professor Elstein pointed to in her talk, the tension between sort of increasing awareness of the needs of the disabled and the dependent and abortion. I think that, and I'll just read the last sentence that I say of that. I think there can be no stability for the right reasons in a political landscape that protects the disabled but denies these protections to the unborn, whether we're talking about the disabled unborn or the non-disabled unborn. I think that tension is a real threat to concerns for the disabled in society broadly, and this is a point that Reinders makes as well. But I'll just go to the conclusion where I want to make two concluding points. On the approach that I've been laying out, the disabled and dependent are not, as Alistair MacIntyre puts it, a special interest, for their interests are the very ones that, shared by all members of the society of overlapping societies, generate the need for political authority. This commonality is one that naturally, however, should direct our attention also to difference. The needs, the lacks, the inadequacies, the various ways in which human persons in society, and indeed many societies themselves, are not self-sufficient, all of these are unique, although they display, of course, many common features. This is seen clearly enough in the range of normal cases. The life best suited to one agent might not be best suited to another. And even an individual agent will have to reflect upon and discern which of the various good options for the shaping of his or her life might be most suitable. But this is true also for the disabled. The particular way of life within which the gifts and capacities of one Down syndrome child will be best pursued and instantiated are not the same for all Down syndrome children. And even the most suitable way of life for this patient in a persistent vegetative state, a way of being with his or her family, of being cared for by his or her neighbors and parishioners, might very well differ from the most suitable way of life for that patient. This need for locality and considerations of individual flourishing should indicate both, one, the importance, where possible, of autonomy and freedom for the disabled, but also, two, the fact that, insofar as either the disabled are not or are not yet autonomous, and insofar as they have needs with respect to which they're not self-sufficient, their primary caregivers will be family members, friends, and local societies such as churches, all of whom are better situated epistemically, emotionally, and volitionally than is the political authority. That is, family members such as parents and spouses, friends, and parishes all have a better grasp of the particular needs and capacities of individuals with disabilities and a greater capacity for emotional involvement and sustained commitment than do agents of the state, generally speaking. The state, it should be clear from this essay, exists as a help or aid to those pursuing their human flourishing, one part of which includes carrying out local and personal responsibilities. Respect for the principle of subsidiarity is thus a requirement of an adequate response on the part of the state to the needs of the disabled, as to the needs of all other persons. As far as possible, the state should not be in the business of taking over care of the disabled, but rather in the business of helping them and their caregivers to live their own particular lives. And a second general point is that the needs that govern the justification for political authority are multiple. Defense against outsiders, for example, and against internal criminality, as well as the coordination of ways of life, partly by provision of infrastructural necessities such as roads and currency. All these activities require resources, which are finite, and whose source is ultimately the citizens of the state. This creates inevitable limits to what the state can do and a need for judgments of prudence in deciding what is possible. It's simply not the case, given the inevitable finitude and frequent scarcity of resources, that the state can provide for every need, and often some needs which could in theory be better satisfied will in fact not be. Such limitations are not matters of injustice. Moreover, in determining what will be done, what money spent, and what resources consumed by and for whom, the state must be fair as regards all its possible beneficiaries. The correlative to not viewing the disabled as a special interest group, but as on equal foundation with all as regards the justification for political authority, is, it seems, that their needs must be balanced against the needs of others, which, while perhaps not as extensive, are nevertheless among the needs for which that authority exists. Consider this in the context of education. It is incumbent upon the state to provide resources by which those with special needs may be aided, but the needs of non-disabled children and also exceptionally gifted children must also be met. Finding the correct balance here is a matter of political prudence. There's no way of privileging one set of needs over the other so as to arrive at a neat solution for the problem of distributing resources. Social justice for the disabled is thus a rigorous requirement of political authority, though it's not the only or an inevitably overriding commitment. But it is a commitment, I've argued here, whose grounding in nature can best be understood from a natural law and not a classically liberal perspective. Thanks.